This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We're talking about kicking it all over with author Keith Farnish. Apparently NASA's James Hansen agrees with you in his review of your book on Amazon. He writes, and I quote this for listeners, "Keith Farnish has it right. Time has practically run out, and the system is the problem. Governments are under the thumb of fossil fuel special interests. They will not look after our and the planet's well-being until we force them to do so, and that is going to require enormous effort," Professor James Hansen of NASA. Keith, James Hansen is now taking a lot of flack from climate deniers and their ilk for saying that.
I'm not sure it's necessarily worrying him too much. He has been taking flack for at least the last 20 years from every way that possibly could give him flack. The coal industry hate him, the oil industry hate him, an awful lot of senators hate him. And when he stood up in front of the Senate in 1988 to essentially explain to the American government the potential horrors we were going to face from climate change, he was public enemy number one as far as the US government was concerned. So this is a little bit of a flash in the pan, but the words that are being used in relation to James Hansen and myself are certainly strong. I've been described as a terrorist, and by connection, so has James Hansen. Words like genocide, eugenics, they've all been used in relation to my book and therefore in relation to James Hansen. Absurd, yes, because at no point have I ever said I want to kill anything off or destroy anything. I genuinely do feel for Hansen because he has put probably more than anyone else of himself into trying to achieve something which is completely dispassionate. It's altruistic. He's not doing it for himself. If he was doing it for himself, then he would be a businessman. And James Hansen doesn't make much money. He's an adjunct professor. He's a research scientist. He doesn't really have anything to gain from this, and he's lost an awful lot in terms of what he could have gone on and become a highly successful scientist, working for a corporation. He chose the other alternative. He chose to stick to pure science, objective science, and he gets hit a lot for this. And certainly, this isn't the first time, and this certainly won't be the last time he's going to get hit for this. I'm proud to call him someone that thinks in a similar way the way I do.
Well, getting back to your book, I think we all fear that our economic system is on life support. You've called for an end to industrialized civilization, saying it will fall apart anyway. Why should we help it go down, and wouldn't we be sabotaging our own way of living?
Well, we would be sabotaging the way of living that is highly destructive. It depends how dependent you are upon it. I believe that there are certain dependencies that we can do without. I'm not talking about immediately walking away and going off-grid and throwing away your job or anything like that. We've all got to live. We've all got to feed our families. We've all got to keep warm. We've all got to have a roof over our heads. And there are many situations in which people are tied to this system. So I would be reckless to say that you must abandon this immediately. However, economic growth is not something that can ever be sustainable. So essentially, by not having economic growth, what you're taking away is something that always takes, something that always destroys. And that's got to be a good thing. And I don't believe that not having economic growth will be destructive to anything but the systems of power that dominate the way we live. I think that undermining or sabotaging the economic growth machine is a fundamentally good thing. And some people have said and written that is effectively terrorism. Well, yes, in a way, because there is something, and I don't know what the term is used in the USA, but in Britain it's called critical national infrastructure. And the large financial organizations within the UK are protected under various laws, various security laws, and no doubt they're protected under the various Patriot Acts and other laws in the USA. because they are considered to be fundamental, they make money for the economy. It is a complete misnomer to place them in the same context as the kind of things that actively save people's lives, like medical services. Yet they are considered, these financial organizations are considered by governments to be just as important as medical services, as the water supply, as the food supply. And there's got to be something wrong there.
One key idea in your book, Time's Up, is that of connection. Can you describe that for us?
It's very difficult to describe any more than one's personal idea of connection, but I can give you an idea of the background. If you look at the way humanity has existed for hundreds of thousands of years, it has required a fundamental connection to the cycles and the processes that take place around the various groups and communities. These groups and communities wouldn't be able to survive if they didn't understand the cycles of nature, if they didn't understand the different ways that animal and plant life and other forms of biological entities coexist. So in effect, these people, as have existed for far longer than civilization has, are part of nature. They are deeply connected to the natural ecosystem. Civilization tries to pull us away from that. It gives us this alternative way of living which requires us to be disconnected. And what I've written about extensively in the book is that we have to become reconnected. Otherwise, I don't think that we can really understand how disconnected we've become. There's a myriad of different ways of connecting. It's unique to the individual. The writer Carolyn Baker talks about this in far more strident terms than I do, and she considers the idea of connection to be a deeply spiritual thing. And in a way it is, because it brings things out of you that most people, certainly people within civilization, haven't realized have been within themselves. So when you sit on a beach, or when you sit in the woods, or when you walk around and you listen, you really listen and really smell and taste and touch what's around you, then it does bring something out in yourself that is spiritual in a way. But that's the connection coming out. This is something that is fundamental to who we are as human beings. And unless we understand that deep connection between humanity and the rest of nature, then I don't believe we're in a position to really understand what we're doing to the world and how we can get back.
The next step, you say, is to focus on the tools of disconnection. What are some of the ways we become separated from real being and the natural reality?
I put down 10 tools, but there may be even more of these. It was really a way of making people understand the different ways that we live have all of them disconnected parts within them. So, for instance, some of the tools I've suggested are, for instance, the way that we're advertised to, this idea that we can have a wonderful way of living, but as long as it's in the same in terms that the corporations sell to us. There are other tools like authority, and if you look at the work of Stanley Milgram, for instance, in the 1950s, he demonstrated unequivocally that you could make people do whatever you want them to do, providing you have this chain of command, this form of authority. And authority is fundamental to the way that civilization works. You have a hierarchy. You look up to people. Some people look down upon others. But essentially, we play a part because there is this authority. But all of this is different. This is not connected to the real world. There's other tools of disconnection which are much more obvious, like abuse, physical abuse. You have military forces which are all around the world abusing people, are killing people. And if you look at, for instance, what goes on in China constantly, then whenever anyone steps out of line and goes against the status quo in China, then they are disappeared. They are taken out of the system. And because there is the potential that they may make other people realize that this isn't quite the way to live. This isn't quite the way that we should be wrong with things. One of these tools of disconnection, which is particularly powerful, which unfortunately a lot of environmentalists are guilty of, is the idea of hope. And I think it was very, very telling that Obama used hope as his most powerful tool for looking towards the future. This message was coming from someone who is, to all intents and purposes, at the head of the system. He has some good intentions. However, the idea of giving someone hope takes away your ability to act. Rather than actually going out and doing something, if you can just be given enough hope, if you can be given the idea that if you hope enough, then things are going to get better, then it disables you. It stops you doing things. So I consider hope to be one of these tools of disconnection as well.
Paul Simon famously sang that there are 100 ways to leave your lover, and Keith Farnish, you've found over 100 ways to undermine the system. Can you give us just a couple of examples?
There's an article I have written on the Earth blog, which is, it's not complete yet, because I keep discovering all these little things. I want to be very clear that the idea of undermining the system is not about, this is not about the things that have been written about in the blogs recently about destroying cities and blowing up dams and things like this. The undermining is about undermining these tools of disconnection. It's about giving people their freedom back. It's about giving people their minds back so they can reconnect. They can live in the way that humanity was meant to live. But there's lots of these ways, and one very easy example is simply turning televisions off. So if you can turn a television off in a public place, people actually realize, and I've experimented doing this in public places, people suddenly come back to their senses. They were blindly watching this screen, churning out adverts, and the TV went off. And I've got a remote control device that does this. And suddenly, they're looking around going, oh, and then they go back to their normal lives. But there's lots more of these things. You could subvertise advertising billboards, so writing things on billboards that actually go counter to the messages that the advertisers want you to do. You could send out fake press releases as a company representative, actually giving the truth about what the company are doing. So, press release, so-and-so company admits to environmental mismanagement. Well, of course, the company wouldn't do that, but of course, if you manage to do it and you make it look convincing enough, then you've undermined that company. But there are dozens and dozens of these things, and I think they're only limited by the imagination.
If I understand you correctly, a few people can start a trend that radiates into much bigger things. You speak of the power of pioneers and early adopters. Tell us about that.
The idea of stratifying society, for want of a better term, is it's really something that you see all the time. The concept is called diffusion of innovations, and it's just one of the ideas that I've touched upon, but it's you're always going to have these pioneers. You're going to have people that take up an idea, and they don't just agree with the idea. They actually act on it. So there are an awful lot of people out there, a surprising number of people, who are really taking the bit between their teeth and starting to live in ways that are far closer to the way humanity was meant to live. And there are other people who are a bit further up. They're a bit further on the time scale, and it's a larger chunk of people, these early adopters. And they may be influenced by these pioneers because they might be in the same peer group or the same social group. And so they're more likely to change than had these pioneers not been there. And then you have these much larger chunks of people, which are the bulk of society, the early and the late majority. And this is what you would probably call in America the middle classes. In Britain we call it middle England, or the people who the governments are always trying to appeal to. This is going to come much later, these kinds of changes, but it can't happen unless these earlier groups start changing, I believe. And it's a little bit more complicated than that, because you also need these connectors and mavens and salespeople, which people have read about in The Tipping Point. These things all fit together, as does the undermining, but you don't actually need millions of people to be actively changing to create change. as long as the momentum gets started up and it's done in the right way, then quite fundamental change can happen with just a few people.
Suppose we hurry the process of crashing civilization. What do you picture happening next?
It's not a nice thing to think about, this idea of crashing civilization. There are various writers like James Kunstler and Carolyn Baker, who I've mentioned, who are very much of the mindset that it's going to happen anyway, and it's going to happen soon. And in fact, it is happening as we speak. Certainly with the economy, we've seen a few of these effects of what happens when a mismanaged economy collapses and the people at the top continue to cream off what they want, but the people at the very bottom suffer the most. This is a symptom of the kinds of things that are happening at the moment. This is crash. Oil crises are going to happen. I believe we've reached the peak, the oil peak. You're going to have other kinds of peaks as well. You're going to have peak gas. You're going to have peak nuclear. And as the energy supplies run out, then you're going to get a strange situation which probably mimics what's happened with the economy, whereby the people at the top get what they want and the people right at the bottom suffer the most. And it's the people who are economically at the bottom who, and particularly urban people, who do tend to suffer most when anything like this does happen. I don't think you can be too explicit about this. If you're in a situation where you're going to suffer anyway because of any of these crashes, and they are going to happen, then you're the people who really need to gear yourself up for this situation. Read authors like Sharon Astick, who writes wonderfully about gearing yourself up for hard times, and try and get out of being so dependent on industrial civilization. It's not easy, but there's certain things you can do to simplify your life that can protect yourself against it. I don't want to cause a destructive crash. I want to somehow get to a situation where we're in control of this slow downfall of civilization. And I think that's a much kinder way of going through the motions of a collapsing civilization than just having these shock, this shock after shock after shock, which is going to happen as the economy and energy and water and all of these other things start crashing.
Where can people find your blog if they want to follow up on this?
Right, well, I've got a website that's got the whole book on, which is the unprinted version, and that's amatterofscale.com. I run something called the Earth Blog, which is theearthblog.org, and on this I publish various essays, which many of them have been extensions on what I've written. And there's also a site called the Unsuiter Blog, so that's just unsuiterblog.com, and it's starting to contain these ideas, these undermining tasks. It's been about greenwashing up to now, but I think we've got to start getting a bit active and start thinking about how to get round this system that tries to take everything away from us. So the Unsuiter Blog's going to get a little bit edgy in the future, and that's probably the one to keep an eye on.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We've been delving into deep green thought with one of Britain's more controversial thinkers, Keith Farnish. He's the author of the book Time's Up, An Uncivilized Solution to a Global Crisis, published by Green Books. Thank you so much, Keith.
Thank you, Alex.
You can find some links to Keith's blogs and his online book in my Radio EcoShock blog dated February 4th, 2010. Just go to ecoshock.org and click on Blog. I've posted a few other goodies for you there as well.
This is EcoShock Radio. All environment, all the time. Get more info on the web at ecoshock.org.
Webcasts are proliferating as various publishers and institutions slash their travel costs. That's good for emissions and a way to let many more people into the virtual room. I attended two this week, just for you. One was a reassessment of Copenhagen and the way forward from the British publisher Earthscan. There I met David Satherwaite, our radio guest next week. His recent work on the realities of human settlement, the slums, and Western consumerism fits in perfectly with the new World Watch 2010 State of the World report. I interview that report's project director, Eric Asadourian, as we ask, is it them or is it us? Next week on Radio EcoShock.
You have heard and seen enough negativity to last a lifetime.
My second webcast was provided by the Center for American Progress and hosted by Uber blogger Joe Rome. His spot, climateprogress.org, really is the indispensable climate blog, as Tom Friedman called it. On the webcast, we got to hear two top American scientists who have helped organize IPCC reports, Dr. Michael McCracken and Dr. Christopher Field. I'm not going to lie to you. At times, the webcast was timid to boring, as the two scientists were so careful about the limits of the IPCC process. You had to reinterpret wonk speak to realize this intergovernmental panel on climate change is really not up to the task of warning the world about the climate threat. Why not? Let me count out just a few reasons. One, the whole pile of summaries, the things you and I and politicians actually read, must be agreed to line by line by each and every government in the world. That means, for example, Saudi Arabia, the giant oil producer who often denies climate change, has to sign on. It's almost like having Dick Cheney approve everything the Obama administration does. Oh wait, it seems like that's happening in the Senate anyway. Two, when incompetence and possible corruption, in the case of the Grand Leader Pachauri, show up, the IPCC has no agency to investigate it, to correct the problem, or even to handle the press. Pachauri was involved with the unscientific and botched prediction about the Himalayan glaciers melting by 2030, now shown to be contrary to the common knowledge of most glacier experts. A member of the team acknowledged they knew the information to be false. Yet Pachauri helped get that wrong information into the report and then personally profited from the panic by the Indian government. His company got fairly big money to find out more about climate change, about a problem which did not exist at the levels claimed. It stinks of corruption, not a new idea at the United Nations. I posted a list of Pachauri's various businesses, and it's a long list, in my blog for this week. He should resign. None of this was mentioned by the upright scientists at the American Progress webcast. They admit a major mistake was made, but don't criticize either the man or the system that let him get away with it. Pitiful. 3. There are lots of things that science simply can't address that matter a lot. For example, when the assembled scientists realized they didn't know how to predict Arctic ice melt, they just left that out of the calculations on sea level rise. So their prediction of a few millimeters rise by 2100 was laughable. There's a lot more unknown unknowns, including public panic, climate wars, and climate trauma, to name just a few. Those demons are outside the realm of science, but definitely part of what we need to understand or at least plan out with the best guesses. 3. The IPCC is always 5 years behind current science. And why do we only report every 5 years on a problem that suggests we only have 10 years left to act, if that? Before nature takes over control of the greenhouse, we need a permanent climate war room, or rather, a climate peace room. 4. Experience with past reports shows the IPCC always underestimates both the urgency, the timing, and the severity of the impacts of climate disruption.
It'll soon be over for you. The rest of us, the walking wounded, must go on living for a while.
What are you talking about? What are you talking about?
You haven't heard?
Heard what?
The radio.
Here are a couple of clips from the webcast. First, Christopher Field echoes almost exactly the theory we heard in our first interview with Tim Garrett. Carbon equals wealth.
This is a figure over about two orders of magnitude of per capita carbon emissions on the vertical axis and per capita economic activity across the horizontal axis. And what you can see is that more or less independent of time, more or less independent of what part of the world you're in, there is a linear relationship in this log-log plot between carbon emissions and economic activity. The big issue in climate change for the future isn't how we deal with the current bucket of emissions. It's how we move from an environment where the world is regulated by this relationship to one where we can break the relationship between carbon emissions and wealth and, you know, enable people to aspire to their legitimate goals for economic advancement without coupling that with carbon emissions.
And finally, Dr. Michael McCracken on everyone's nightmare, melting permafrost.
Until now, humans have emitted something like 500 billion tons of carbon to the atmosphere by deforestation and combustion of fossil fuels. That's really a lot. The amount of carbon that's frozen in permafrost is probably about 1,500 billion tons, about three times as much as we've emitted through all of human history. Large amounts of that permafrost are in the coldest parts of the world, unlikely to thaw in the near term, but quite a lot of it is in areas where the climate has already warmed dramatically and where future dramatic warming could result in losses of large amounts of permafrost. Some of the climate model calculations have more than half the permafrost disappearing by 2100. How much disappears is, of course, a function of how much the climate warms. And one of the things that's most intimidating about the high-latitude carbon stores is that we don't really know at what point they begin to lose so much carbon that we really can't shut it off. There was a really interesting series of papers published in 2008 showing that metabolism of this carbon, which is actually quite easily decomposed, it's basically easily decomposed plants that were frozen 20 to 40,000 years ago, generates heat, and that in many areas of the world, especially the windblown Yetima sediments across Siberia, which hold more than 500 billion tons of carbon, you can actually create conditions where the decomposition of this material occurs fast enough so that the heat generated by the decomposition sustains the thawing, even if the temperature doesn't continue to increase. And that represents another one of these classic tipping points where once you reach a certain level of decomposition, it's not clear how it will get shut off.
That's all from the webcast by the Center for American Progress, February 2nd, 2010. It was hosted by Joe Rome, superclimate blogger at climateprogress.org. Most of the talk about the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was diplomatic and disappointing. The IPCC, and in fact the whole UN system for negotiations, is plainly not working. If anything, it may be working against us. Frankly, we need a new public body to measure and predict the climate threat in real time. Let scientists say what they can prove without censorship from Saudi Arabia, George Bush, or whoever. Maybe it can all be built as a knowledge machine on the internet. Heaven knows who will fund and control it. Maybe some billionaire will care enough about the future to fund it and let it go without strings. Maybe we can find a few honest men and honest women. Something has to change, or we are toast. Can the public stomach the awful truth, or will we go down in a sea of denial and business as usual? It's almost to the point where the danger to the world as we know it might matter as much as the Toyota recall or who won the Oscars. I know that's a big claim, but that's the way I see it. I'm Alex Smith. Thanks for listening. This is Radio EcoShock. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org.